When my grandmother passed away in 2017, someone asked me, they said, well, what are some of the special things you learned from your grandmother? And I said, how to save a bag. You never know when you're going to need a good bag. And when reusable bags came along, I mean, that was a game changer. We had plastic bags from you know, shopping places that had gone under years ago. Some of them belonged in a museum, but... Yes, always save a bag. I've found out over the years that my creative process is like collage, figuratively speaking. If I have all the pieces, I can make a picture. but we might not have the picture right this moment. Can everyone hear okay? Is that good? Okay. Picture it, August 1994, Geneva Point Center on beautiful Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire. It's the fourth week of the month, and the heat and humidity have given way to air that is a little cooler, a little drier, summer perfection. It's the third day of Winnie Farthest Out, and folks are settled into the rhythm of the program. A 14-year-old boy is attending Winnie for the first time. The part of the program called Rhythms has ended. Accompanied by some others, the boy meanders down a wooded path to a building called Lakeview Lodge, a building that resembles an Econo Lodge, but is somehow the most expensive place to stay on the grounds. The boy and others enter the common area of the building where a group is getting ready to engage in an hour of creative writing, followed by sharing. The leader is a man with a funny, joyous disposition. His name is Eric Nielsen. The last person enters the room, the group settles in, and Eric calls the group to a moment of silence and then offers some inspirational words to whet the creative appetite for writing. And here's what he shares. A quote from Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he that sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round and pluck blackberries. And then Eric shares a short response from an author I can't remember to this quote. And it simply goes like this. Enough plucking of blackberries. The boy was me, obviously, and that was my wake-up call into what Glenn Clark calls kingdom living. That was the moment. That very moment in creative writing with that short call, enough plucking of blackberries. The bush is on fire, for God's sake. Get out there. My name is Dana Belmonte, if you don't know me, and I want to thank the Council Ring for praying and inviting me to be a lamplighter this week. I'm here to tell you that I've got a river of life flowing out of me, and I would like to share a little bit about that with you today, and the operative word is share. I'm not here to bottle the river water and try to sell it to you. I am simply here to share. And if anything I say today gets you thinking and you'd like to talk to me more about something, be it at lunch, dinner, or on the porch, I welcome that conversation, just not at breakfast. To quote Duke Ellington, breakfast is my foundation meal. I don't know what's coming the rest of the day. I can't gamble on that one. That's my preparation time. I think we've heard something like this a few times already, but here's a little Glenn Clark for you from Windows of Heaven. We are told that the only way to find God is through meditation and prayer. But there is a greater discovery which, when truly understood, makes you master over all circumstances. And it is this: God is everywhere. That means God is in the without, just as surely as God is in the within. So, find God in the routine of life. Greet each new day with expectancy and wonder, like a little child. Move courageously into the main streams of life. Appreciate all the earnest efforts of other persons. Lend them your support to establish God's purposes, and believe in the real love which motivates even their crudest attempts. I was just reminded of that last week. Their crudest attempts to give aid and comfort. See every other human being as a divine instrument and accept all of the events of your life with the radiant certainty that God is in them. When Barbara Diehl was here a couple of years ago, we heard a lot from The Divine Plan by Gled Clark. And if you've talked to Tanya Cothran at all, you know that she's the executive director of an organization called Spirit in Action. Spirit in Action works to provide startup grants, not loans, but grants to small business people in various countries in Africa, Malawi, Kenya, and Uganda right now. And these grants, I had the opportunity to travel to Africa a couple of years ago with Mike Hageman and with Tanya and with Boyd, and these grants are life-changing. We saw people who had started sustainable businesses and had turned their lives around just with these small grants of, you know, $100, $200, $300, our money. But one of the things that's really special, there's many things special about Spirit in Action, but one of the really special things is what Spirit in Action calls mindset preparation. Some of these grants are more money than some of these people have ever seen. And I would liken it to put it in our culture, take a high school graduate and say, okay, you've graduated from high school, here's $15,000. Go ahead, this is for you, take it. You know, don't spend it all in one place. without some instruction around that, I'm not sure that that's a good idea. Maybe you'd agree. And that's kind of what it's like giving a business grant to someone who doesn't know anything about business or needs some instruction. So that there's a whole book of business instruction for the people that get SIA grants. And a big part of it is mindset preparation, preparing for receiving that grant and knowing what to do with it, how to keep records, how to do your accounting, crafting a business plan, all of those things. And it's just such an important part. Sounds kind of basic, but it's so important. Again, comparing it to a high schooler getting $10,000. Does a high schooler know what to do with $10,000 or $15,000 in the United States? I don't. I taught high school for 13 years. I'm going to say no. From The Divine Plan again. I believe that the gifts of God are many thousands of times greater than I am now capable of receiving, and that I should therefore pray to increase my capacity both to receive and to give. For my power to receive is as great as my power to give, and my power to give as to receive. Again, gifts of God, thousands of times greater than I am now capable of receiving. I see our time here in Journey Farthest Out as mindset preparation. The beginning of my mindset preparation was that moment in creative writing. There's a lot that's happened after that. I was only a high schooler then. But we're always preparing ourselves to receive more of what God has for us. There's so much. The bush is on fire, you know. And so I liken this time in Journey Farthest Out to mindset preparation, or mind, body, soul, spirit preparation. Because we don't know what to do all the time with the blessings that are dumped in our lap, or the person that crosses our path. If that person's going to be a gift, we have to be prepared to know that that's a gift and recognize that that's a gift. And that's one of the big things that I get out of coming to Winnie every year, is this continuing, you know, make me ready, Lord, for the gifts that you have, the greater, the better, the more. God's abundance is infinite. So that concept of mindset preparation with spirit in action really speaks to me. So, after graduating college, which was 2001 for me, I took a job at a Catholic college prep school for boys just southwest of Boston. I was prepared, leaving college, to go anywhere and teach in a public school. I had my certification, I was ready. I had heard about some of the cities in the United States that were kind of growing and where jobs would be available. And I put out a lot of resumes and did quite a few interviews. And the funny thing was this job at the Catholic school seemed to be the one that I kind of worked the least to entertain. And ended up going on 3 interviews there, simply because each interview, they had just finished a big construction project, so they were kind of unprepared, and each interview kind of left loose ends open. And I was like, oh yeah, we didn't cover that. Oh, we didn't cover that. How much were you paying again? There were just all kinds of questions. So after interview number 2, they offered me the job, and I called back. I said, thanks so much. I said, but I still have a few items we haven't checked here yet. So I ended up taking that job because I had attended Catholic school from 6th grade through 12th grade for the simple reason that I was a discipline problem. And and in 5th grade, my dad's solution to that was you're going to Catholic school. And I remember, I saw my great-grandmother one day, in September of my first year at Catholic school with my uniform on, and she was so proud of that because she was Catholic and just loved that. And she said to me, and my great-grandmother was, she came over from Italy. She says, is that your new uniform? She said it just like that. And I said, yes. And my dad said, yes, it is, Nani. He says, it's to go with his new attitude. But Catholic school was the best thing for me. It really did provide a discipline that I needed at the time, and it really gave me a lot of skills going into college. I was very thankful for it all. So when this Catholic job at a Catholic school that needed a music program and asked me to build it from the beginning opened up, I said, this could work. And I knew enough about Catholic school to know what I was getting into. There is a playbook. It's not published. And if you want to talk to me about that later, you can. But it was a wonderful time. It started out kind of rough. The classroom was in shambles. I ended up having to clean it. There was no help. Things ironed out in that area. One of the things that kind of gave me a signal that this might be the right job at the moment was this. The Order of Catholic Brothers that founded the school embraced the same philosophy that I was just talking about from Glenn Clark. And they word it like this. Be patient, therefore, with yourself and with God. If you allow yourself to be formed by God through the common, ordinary, unspectacular flow of everyday life, you will gradually experience a liberation and a freedom never before imagined. And yeah, there were some of the days were really common flow, just getting through it. But remembering that made it wonderful. So when I started teaching, it was in 2001, we arrived for the faculty days. Fortunately, there were only 3 of them. The administration really didn't feel the need to hold court for too long, and 3 days was just enough because you really need to get students in the building. That's why we're there. And too many teachers in one place with no students, don't bother. So I got to the faculty days, and one of the things that was happening was they were training for a new system with the computer. Like, everything had gone electronic at that at that moment, and some of the older faculty were a little nervous. And one of the first people I met was a wonderful man by the name of Charlie McNamee. Charlie was the oldest teacher in the building, and he was particularly nervous about all of this technological change, and so he sat next to me in the faculty day because he said, "You're new." He said, "You can help me through this." And I said, "I'll do everything I can, Charlie. That'd be great." So we started up this training, and we got into like five steps, you know, like log in, go to this website, type in your password, here's your class list, blah, blah, blah. I'm doing all of this and moving right along, and I glance over, and Charlie's laptop isn't even on. I'm like, "Charlie, you got to keep up." So I did what I did for my grandmother and my great aunts and uncles. I broke out the legal pad and a Sharpie marker and, you know, wrote out like block directions. Like for my grandmother, it was to use the TV remote. For Charlie, it was to do his grades. And Charlie was very appreciative of that. And Charlie and I got to be friends. Charlie was a really interesting guy. He was, in his younger years, he was a Trappist monk. And he was really good friends with a guy named Thomas Keating, who you may know from his talk of contemplative prayer, his book Open Mind, Open Heart. So like Charlie was like on, you know, speed dial with that guy. So it was fun to hear about his talks with Thomas Keating and his friendship with him. Charlie again was, again, funny guy. He was a Trappist monk, and then he fell in love with a nun, and they both left the order and they got married. And Charlie has passed now, but then they got a divorce, and that, you know, set up all kinds of problems. And, you know, Charlie was a very committed Catholic, but Charlie, in our language, was farthest out. And, you know, talking to him about spirituality and religion was always such a treat. But the school he used to teach theology at the school, but then at some point that the administration kind of lovingly said, "We love you and you can't teach theology anymore." So he had to go to his other discipline and teach science. He taught physics. But he still managed to get a lot of spirituality into that, and his students really, you know, respected and loved Charlie for that. And so Charlie and I got to be friends in the faculty days, and then about 3 months in, you know, I was getting used to my classes and my students, and this one student showed up. His name was Matthew, and he was in my guitar class, and he kind of changed my whole outlook right off the bat of what teaching was going to be about. This was a college prep school, and there was a lot of affluence in the community, and Matthew's family did not have that. And so that, you know, made it a little uncomfortable for him at times because of just the culture. And as teachers, we worked to, you know, make sure that that culture didn't get out of control, but, you know, there are issues. And so Matthew's parents worked, both of them were out of the house a lot, and there were other things going on at home that made it troublesome for him. And so he would come into school, and he was a really good kid, but he just didn't have any focus and didn't have that anchor that was needed to help him, you know, find his way. And even in a Catholic school, kind of the regiment and the discipline was not taking. So he was in my guitar class. I taught beginning guitar, and that's all. I'm not a guitarist. After the kids didn't know that until about 2 weeks before the end of the class. And I was like, "Now you're a great candidate for private lessons. Have a good one." At one point, Charlie and I were out for a faculty, you know, on Fridays, sometimes the faculty would go to the local restaurant, and Charlie and I were talking, and he says, "Do you have Matt in your class?" And I said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Do you have him?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "He's a really good kid." I said, "And he's fighting a lot of things." He says, "We need to look out for him." And I'll just pause for a moment and say, I still talk with Matthew. He's a good friend, and I have permission to tell this story. So Charlie and I kind of, you know, united in a little, you know, a looking out for Matt. We kind of became Team Matthew, and along with one other teacher named Joe. So we started watching out for him and started to just kind of give him instruction when he needed it, or if things looked like they were going to boil over, we'd try to pull it back as best we could. It became, at a certain point, Matthew approached me. And he said, "Gee, Mr. Belmonte," he says, "I'm really liking music." He says, this is great. He says, I think I want to major in it in college. Now, this was my first year teaching. And if you know about majoring in music, most people that major in music have been playing their instrument for a while. If you haven't been playing before high school, it's kind of this catch-up work to do. It can be done, but there's a lot to do. And Matthew was in my guitar class, and he also played drums in the after-school jazz band, but his skills were not that great. To say that the drums sounded like pots and pans were kind of, that was a compliment. I mean, it was like, he could play in 4/4 time, but if we switched to 3/4 time, that would really throw him off, and you could see his face kind of do that. And he was also a sophomore. And if you know anything about sophomores in adolescent development, the sophomore year is, I think, it's just one of the toughest years. My phrase was, sophomores are what happen when you feed freshmen after midnight. If you've ever seen the movie Gremlins, you know what I'm talking about. I loved the sophomores. They were great, but they just have an energy that's all over the place. They're either way up here or way down here. They're either totally interested or not interested at all. And you have to really work to harness that energy. And many of my colleagues would always complain about the sophomores. And I would complain too, but in a music classroom, at least everybody you think wants to be there, so it made it a little bit easier. Well, Matthew was a sophomore. He had no music skills whatsoever. He just liked music and was taking my guitar class and played a little drums. Says to me, I want to major in music when I go to college. And I thought to myself, fortunately, I held myself back. I didn't want to shatter any dreams in that moment or whatever. And I just said, wow, I said, that's a good thought. Wonderful. Why don't we make an appointment later in the week and you can come and we'll talk about what that entails. I said, because there's a few things you might want to know. And you're a sophomore, I said, so you have some time to think about what else you'd like to do. So Matt did come back for that appointment, and we talked through everything, and I didn't want to discourage him, but I did lay it out truthfully. I said, well, I said, how long have you been playing your instrument? He's like, a couple months. That was when I met him. I said, well, here's what you have to do. I said, if you really want to major in music, you really need to get a private lesson teacher for the instrument that you want to pursue right now. I said, you also need to practice, 2 to 3 hours a day. I said, most people who go into music have been playing their instrument a while, and you've got to make up some time. I said, 2 and 3 hours is not unrealistic for practice time. I said, because, I won't see you over the summer, and you really need to continue playing over the summer, and if you could find a summer program that teaches, and work over the summer, and I suggested Berkeley, and then there was some other things going on in Boston, I said, you really need to do that. I said, you, this may very well be possible for you, but you do have some miles to cover. I said, I'm not going to lie to you. So think about all of that. Here's the list. And there was more on the list. I gave him a whole 8.5 by 11 with many points on it. I said, try that. Well, he took that. A few weeks went by. I saw him in guitar class, talked to Charlie a little bit more about how he was doing. And then something happened. In Matthew's math class, evidently there was a fight. And it was between Matthew and another student. Something happened, and I don't know what it was, but fortunately, the whole issue got smoothed over. But when I saw Matthew later in the day, he walked into the room, and he just had such a down demeanor about him. And he said to me, he says, I bet you think I'm a criminal. And I said, no, I don't think you're a criminal. I said, I don't know what happened in your math class. I said, but maybe there was a situation that could have been handled better. I said, but nevertheless, I said, I think what you need to do is, apologize, take whatever's coming from the dean's office, and let's just see if we can get beyond this. In the meantime, Charlie had talked to him and had given him a copy of The Art of War and said, read this. So fortunately, that situation got solved because there were, three sides to every story, yours, mine, and what really happened. And we moved beyond that. And at one point, Matt was talking to me. We had a jazz band rehearsal. We were, after the jazz band rehearsal, I had to get out the door really quick. And so I said to the kids, I said, all right, pack it up. We got to move. It's time to go, closing up shop here. And Matthew was also moving very quickly. And the other kids got out, and Matthew was getting his stuff and getting out the door. And I said, gee, where are you going in such a rush? I said, usually you want to hang out and play the drums until I lock the door. He says, my parents are away. He says, I have to go shopping and cook for my grandmother. And it was just funny in that moment because that's exactly what I was rushing off out the door to do. I was going to shop and cook for my grandmother that night. And I said, you too. So, later on, when Matthew and I were talking, he revealed to me that his brother had gotten wrapped up in drug dealing, and as a junior higher, Matthew had to testify against him, and it made things in his household very hard, especially too with his parents working and being far away a lot of the time. I found out he was the only one at home, and that sometimes he didn't even go home at night. And when that's happening, how can you reasonably expect a student to be getting things done that they need to be getting done? You have to work with kind of individuals. And so we begin to kind of work with that. Well, the summer came, and Matthew had gotten a private lesson teacher, but that was only kind of about 8 weeks leading up to summer. And on the way out the door that summer, he says to me, oh, by the way, he says, I'm going to the Berkeley program. I said, oh, well, what week are you doing? He says, I'm doing all of them. He says, I'm going for the six-week program. I said, really? I said, that's great. That's wonderful. I hope you have a great time. I'll look forward to hearing all about it in more ways than one. And he said to me, oh, and by the way, he says, they gave me a scholarship. He had filled out an application, and the application was accepted. And they had given him a scholarship for the whole 6 weeks, so he didn't have to pay anything for it. I was like, wow. I said, how did you do that? He said, I don't know. They had some paperwork. I filled it out. Well, summer is a glorious time for students and teachers alike. And by the time we got back, everyone was refreshed. And now Matthew was a junior. Juniors I always loved, even a little bit more than the seniors, because seniors kind of have their foot out the door, or at least one foot out the door, and Matthew, being a junior, the juniors were always the workhorses. They were kind of really the leaders, and in an ensemble and preparing music stuff, you know, you're not just doing classroom things, you're preparing performances, and people get to see and hear that. So there's always this drive for, you know, you're working on process, but you've got to produce some product. And so day one, September, jazz band rehearsal after school. We get all the kids in there, and Matthew, you know, Matt comes in the door last. I'm like, where's Matthew? He comes in the door last. But this time he comes in, he's standing taller. He's got his book bag, but he also has like a bag for his cymbals. And not just a little bag for his drumsticks, but the whole, you know, roll out every drumstick you could possibly need. Drumsticks, hot rods, brushes, mallets, everything. And he walked over to the drum set, which was newly purchased that summer, which I was happy to get. And he sat down at the drum set like he owned it. And he looked at the new drum set and he said, Mr. Belmonte, he says, yeah, this is great. I said, okay. I said, I'm glad you like it. I said, we have a lot to do. So we started in on the rehearsal, and the first song we were going to play was, you've probably heard that old tune, Holiday for Strings. Anyway, it's very fast. The guitars had a lot of work to do, and it was a very fast swing. And I said, okay, this is fast. Let's try this up to tempo just to see what we have to work towards. And so I gave the downbeat, and he was right in with me on the downbeat, and he had his brushes out for the swing, and he kept right up with it. And so for about eight to 12 bars, I'm like watching this happen while the rest of the students are like fumbling with their instruments. And I just looked over, and I was like, I gave the cutoff, and I was like, I just looked over and said, wow. I said, somebody's been working. He says, yeah. He says, it was a great summer. And so it was hysterical. I mean, he came back with skills like night and day. He had taken the list that I gave him that I was hoping to kind of discourage him with because I wasn't thinking it was going to be realistic, but I knew what he needed to do if he was going to catch up, and he actually did it. So he came back, and junior year for him was off to a great start. I wish I could tell you it was all wonderful at that point, but unfortunately it wasn't. Matthew still had a lot of anger issues and things, you know, and there were constantly discipline issues through the year. And I was constantly running to Charlie or his guidance counselor or the assistant principal to make an excuse or to say, you know what, I know this is awful, but you know, if you could just deal with this or if there's something we can do. I wasn't trying to work the angles too much because you really can't do that, but and there were a few times where I sat Matthew down and I said, listen, I said, you've proven that you know how to work hard now. I said, you now need to do that everywhere. I said, because Charlie and I can't protect you, okay? You need to do this. And he took that somewhat seriously. And there was one point where there was one memorable meeting in the assistant principal's office with all of Matthew's teachers. And I was the only one that had anything good to say because he didn't have Charlie in class anymore. So, but I made my best case. I thought I really Perry Masoned it there. It's like he's worked hard. He got a scholarship to Berkeley. He's done this. He's like, he can work hard in your classes, but you have to demand it. And you know, so fortunately we got through that, and his senior year came along and he was getting better and better, taking lessons, went back to Berkeley, did a lot of things, and his skills just kept going up, 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 up. But he still had a lot going on at home and a lot of personal problems that he was working with. And we finally got to the end of the year, and it was like his senior year, and we were having a talent show, and yet another issue had happened between him and another student, and I had to go to the principal's office and go to bat one more time. And I pulled Matthew aside. I said, there are 5 days left. I said, I have seen people with less time than that not walk across that stage. I said, you do just on the down low. And he was like, just get by it. And so things were improving, but still it was rough. And finally, he did graduate, and everything was wonderful. And the seniors graduate a little bit earlier than everybody else, so there's 2 weeks left of classes. So after that, the seniors kind of drop in for a little visit and, you know, to show how big they are. And like, oh, I don't have to be here, but I am for some reason. And they say hi, and they tell you what's up for this summer, where they're going to college, and all that. Well, Matthew came in to say goodbye and say hi. And it was just funny, because he looked at me, he said, guess what, Mr. Belmonte? He says, I got tickets to go see Dave Brubeck at Berkeley. I said, really? I said, I didn't even know he was in town. I said, how did you do that? I said, I've been working too hard. I got to get online and get some tickets myself. And he looked at me, he said, no, 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 no. He says, I have tickets to Dave Brubeck. And he held up two tickets. He says, and you and I are going. And I'm looking at these two tickets, and then I'm like, it says Dave Brubeck on it. I was like, I love Dave Brubeck. How can you not love Dave Brubeck? Dave Brubeck is awesome. If you've never heard any Dave Brubeck, please, please, get on it. The bush is on fire. Go. So he holds up these tickets, and I'm thinking, this is awesome. But then all of a sudden, you got to remember, I'm in my third year of teaching, and some of those professionalisms are, you know, going through my brain. And I said, oh my, I said, I'm thinking, I don't know if this is appropriate. Do I go to a concert with a student? You know, he just graduated. I don't know. Is this cool? Is this not? And I kind of thought about it while looking at those tickets, and I knew what I had to say. I looked at Matt and I said, thank you so much for purchasing those. I said, it really means a lot to me that you would do that. And we're really going to need to get something to eat before we go see Dave Brubeck. And we did a little celebratory dance. And I went to the piano and he went to the drums and we banged out a little bit of Take Five and it sounded horrible. And we said, let's leave that to Dave. I said, I'll meet you at the subway near Berkeley on whatever night it was. I think it was a Thursday night concert. And Dave came out on Thursday night, and he was 80 years old at the time, and he was awesome. the big lesson from Dave Brubeck, you know, people would ask him in, you know, his late 70s and 80s, they were like, how do you do it? How do you keep the schedule? How do you tour? And he would just say, you know what, you really have to just make the appointment and know that you'll be there. And if for some reason you're not, you're not. But don't not make the appointment. And that's kind of my little encouragement for everybody today is, you know, don't not make the appointment. You know, put it down on the calendar. You can always use pencil. It can always change. Things will change. And, but make the appointment. Believe that you'll be there. I learned that lesson 3 years ago, going to the Philippines and then on to Africa, then on to Europe and back. When you're doing an around the world tour, you just kind of have to say, I guess I'm going to be there. Or if somebody's in need, I guess I'm going to be there. I guess I'm going to have time for that. I guess God's going to pave the way. It's going to happen. You know, book it. Fine. All right. If I'm not there, God will weave it around somehow, whatever. So make the appointment. Believe you'll be there. Now, things do change. When Matthew graduated from school and went on, I didn't hear from him for a couple of years, but that was fine. And he came back and said hi at one point, and he had started to form a band. And the band title was called Protean Collective. Now, at the time, I admit, I had to look up the word protean. Protean means always changing, always growing, tending to change, or frequently, or easily. And the collective part of it for him was that he wanted the band to be a collective effort. And that's another kind of Glenn Clark thing for me, this kind of protean collective we have here. When we come to the Journey Farthest Out, we don't know what's going to happen. There's nothing that's supposed to happen. We come here knowing that as we enter this schedule that we do every day and, you know, enter into it with open minds and open hearts, as Thomas Keating would say, that we're going to get something, and we're going to get what we need, and somebody else is going to get what they need, and another person is going to get what they need, and it's not going to look alike, and that is okay. That's just fine. So Protean Collective, it's a heavy metal band. To tell you the truth, I'm not into it. I went to one of their concerts just for fun. Heavy metal's a little heavy for me. But I like that name, Protean Collective. One of the big things about Journeying Farthest Out that Glenn Clark wanted to get to was this concept of creative living. And I just want to encourage everybody, you know, you do not have to be a musician or a visual artist to engage in creative living. Creativity is very much, I believe, a choice. Some people like to say, oh, I'm not creative. I've done enough reading now, and we can talk about this later if you want, that I really believe that that's not true. Creativity is a mindset. Creativity is a habit. It's knowing, that's why when we go down to creative art and all of the tools are just there, you have to know that those tools have things that they can do, and you trust that you're working with that, and that something's going to come of it, and that if it's not exactly what you envisioned right off the bat, that's okay. The end result, oftentimes in creative process, is not what you originally envisioned. It morphs. It changes. Things have to grow. Change is inevitable. Growth is optional. And the funny thing about that statement is I think that I've had to admit, at least to myself, that, you know, we don't want, growing sounds good, but we really don't want to do it. We're comfortable. We have things the way we want them. When it came time for me to grow after 13 years of teaching, this little quote from Frank Laubach rang very true. Has God ever struck you as the great stirrer up? One thing God seems to have determined is that we shall not fall asleep. We make or discover paradises for ourselves, and these paradises begin to lull us into sleepy satisfaction. Then God comes with an awakening hand, takes us by the shoulders, gives us a thorough awakening, and God knows we need it. We need to have the shells broken quite frequently so that we can grow. I'm very thankful for Journey Farthest Out and everything that I've learned here simply because it's a safe place for that shattering to happen. Shattering is not a comfortable word. And I've had a lot of shattering here and there, and Winnie has always been there to kind of help me put the pieces back together, add new pieces, fill in the cracks with gold, whatever picture you want to paint. And so it's been wonderful. I'll just close with these lyrics. I can find them. This is a hymn text by a guy named Dan Damon. He lives on the West Coast. He's a Methodist minister. He's alive and well, so there's a living composer. And this is called "The Earth is Like a Burning Bush." The earth is like a burning bush that greed may yet consume, but day by day we feel the push of life in every bloom. The voice of rock and river rings the lessons we may learn. It drowns the din of lesser things and calls as seasons turn. Sit still, listen long and hard, as seed lies in the ground. Our teacher, Earth, is not so charred that hope cannot be found. The spirit, like an eagle, screams a warning and a prayer. Let go of greedy plans and schemes. Connect, create, and share. And so as this week continues, I hope that we all reach further out and go farther out to connect, to create, and to share. Thank you so much for the role you've all played in my life for the last 25 years now. Amen.